This is Radio Frontier Channel for Sunday, July 3rd, 2005. Exploring the frontiers of science and technology, from outer space to cyberspace and destinations in between. This is Radio Frontier Channel. I'm your host, Richard Leese. A few weeks ago, I participated in the Astronomical Council of Doom podcast, created by the funny and brilliant folks over at Slacker Astronomy. A few of us astronomy geeks discussed the future direction of the space program, media coverage of astronomy topics, and our favorite science fiction movies and television shows. All the podcasts, including Singularity, Skepticality, The Universe Today, Slacker Astronomy, and Radio Frontier Channel, took the resulting discussion and edited it for their own show. Here's my version, Episode 8 of Radio Frontier Channel. Please send in your comments after the show. You can leave a voicemail message by calling the Radio Frontier Channel hotline at 206-202-3311. You can also send me email. The address is frontierchannel@frontierchannel.tv. Want an easy way to subscribe to the show? Head on over to the podcast section in iTunes version 4.9 and look under the science category. Press the subscribe button and let iTunes do the rest. If you like Radio Frontier Channel, consider voting for it at Podcast Alley, www.podcastalley.com. A direct link to the Podcast Alley listing for Radio Frontier Channel will be provided in the show notes. Want to help support the show? Make a donation on the website.
Welcome to Slacker Astronomy and our first Council of Doom show. And we have brought online here with us a number of unsavory characters. We're not really sure. We're going to find out. some fellow astronomy podcasters, and we want to welcome them now. We've got some technical stuff worked out here. It's very, very scientific and advanced and futuristic. And so hopefully we can... Yes, there's satellite beams and lasers and all kinds of things. So we're going to start off the Council of Doom show. Let's start off by, of course, I'm here joined as usual by Aaron and Pamela, and let's just go around real quickly, and you guys can introduce yourself and introduce yourselves, say a brief thing about what your podcast is about, and a little bit maybe just really quickly why you started your podcast and anything else you want to throw in real quickly. So let's start with we'll start with Derek.
Our podcast is Skepticality, and what we do is we're a podcast that does a critical look at almost any topic that includes historical legends, events, conspiracy theories, news stories, etc.
Science.
And science, which is probably why we're here. And mm-hmm. Our website is www.skepticality.com. That's SKEPTICLITY.
You missed the A, but that's okay.
I missed it.
We'll put all this in the show notes.
Cold spelling.
All right, let's move on down the list now. I'm looking at the next name, which is Fraser Kane.
That's me.
That's you.
So I'm Fraser Kane, and I'm the publisher of Universe Today, which has been around for about 6 years, which is my daily space and astronomy news website. And I guess I started the podcast about a month ago after seeing this Slacker Astronomy one. It really kind of got me worried that I had to catch up. So I got the podcast going.
That's not hard.
Yeah, Bill Plate was freaking me out with, I was going to lose all this ground, so I caught up.
But, well, that's a pretty good reason.
Yeah, well, so I do... Mine's, I think, kind of different from yours. I normally interview... sort of a person about once a week or so who's involved with a newly breaking space and astronomy news story. So we just yak for about 10 minutes through Skype, and I record it and post it and go to bed.
Excellent. Make it sound so easy. Next on the list is Mr. Can. It's a very positive name. We were talking about that before. Mr. Can. Tell us a little bit about your podcast.
My podcast is the Singularity Podcast, and I mainly did it for physics, but I have covered space stuff. I started it because I finished school and entered the real world, and but still wanted to hold on to some physics and astronomy roots. So that's why I did the podcast, and I try and answer questions and explain stuff to light science geeks and non-science geeks. And you can find it at my website, which is cymek.com, which is cymek.com.
Excellent. And Richard is last on my list here.
Yes, Richard Leese. I'm from Radio Frontier Channel. I started that podcast because I didn't really hear the mix of technology and science that I wanted to hear. And since no one else was doing it, I decided to try it out myself. So my focus tends to be on planetary science.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for joining us, and we're going to get started. Basically, the way the Council of Doom show here is going to work is we've got a couple of questions, some topics, you know, we're going to bring up, and we'll sort of discuss them. There's no real set timetable on discussing certain topics, but we'll try to keep everybody wrangled into a something reasonable time-wise. So the topic we wanted to bring up for discussion first is the big news that, of course, came out, I think it was January of 2004, I think, is, of course, the big news and all the planning that's going into this, this new plan, from the Bush administration to go to the moon, go back to the moon, and to go to Mars. And all of the mission directives that they've had for NASA. And we wanted to maybe discuss that a little bit. Is this good? Is it bad? What does this mean? Is this the direction that we should be heading in? Is this the direction that NASA should be heading in? Your thoughts. Derek, let's start with you.
I think it's a great thing, myself, if they can actually get it through and get it approved. And actually if they are serious to get it done. I noticed there's been a lot of hesitation when we get into space programs nowadays. When there's any little problem, we like to over micromanage it and have a lot of red tape involved. So I always have my hesitations there. But I think that any time you end up trying to send people out into a voyage, whether it be in the old days crossing the ocean or getting to the moon the first time or even getting to Mars or to the moon a second time, the technology leaps that go along with just trying to get us there trickle out into A, the economy, and B, just into the human spirit alone, and we end up with a lot of advancements in science, in spirit, in, you know, the whole togetherness of voyage. And people inherently like to voyage, and if we don't continue that, I think we're just going to fester here on the planet like we have been for the past, you know, 40 years, where there's no forward look, there's no final frontier out there that we're aiming for anymore. And I think that it's shown, you know, that there's just nothing that people strive for other than, you know, the next, I don't know, American Idol.
Fraser, let's go to you. Any thoughts on this particular topic?
Well, I'm a big fan too. Putting people back on the moon, putting people on the surface of Mars is great. I mean, you know, in my opinion, the very survival of the human race depends on us getting into space. I mean, whether we're going to do it later or whether we're going to do it sooner, we got to get around to it at some point, so it might as well be now. And my only concern is just that that this whole process gets moving with such momentum that, you know, administration changes, technology glitches, stuff like that doesn't, you know, turn things away and have it end up with footprints on the moon again and then a program that stops again. So I think that's the big challenge. If they can get past that, then the future looks golden.
Great. Mr. Can, your thoughts?
I have a few thoughts, but on this subject, I like the idea, but I don't think it's going to work the way it's planned out, and I think it's really poor for an administration to make a call for a space mission. It should be put in the hands of NASA if you want the government to run it. And I think the problem with Bush calling for it and laying out his own little plan is whoever comes in next is going to want to leave their mark, and they're going to push his plan to the side and either cancel it altogether or put their own plan in, which is going to slow it down even more. I really think someone needs to put in charge of NASA that will step up and say, this is what we need to do, this is how we're going to do it, and this is how long it's going to take us.
Richard, any thoughts?
Well, I agree with Mr. Can. I have mixed feelings about it. I'm excited about the effort, but with the new administrator, I noticed there's been a lot of talk of some major changes to the steps they're going to take towards these goals, and I'm kind of afraid this, in the same way, a new administrator comes along and will shake up the plans, and we won't necessarily reach any final goal. It'll always be this shakeup. So it would be nice if there was really a focus that lasted long term, but we'll see what happens.
Do either of you guys have anything? Did you want to add, Pamela? Or?
Well, I think I'm going to be the lone voice here saying
nope.
That...
I'll back you up.
Sending men to the moon, and moon is cool. I'm down with going to the moon. But Mars right now, you know, until we consistently get this whole centimeters inch thing straight and we figure out how to land things without bouncing them on airbags.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be in a rocket that gets bounced around on airbags and yeah, no, not going to happen. But most of all, I'm worried about, you know, Japan was supposed to be part of the International Space Station, and we've dragged this out for so long and screwed so many things up that I don't think they're ever going to get their pod, and I just don't want Mars to be another way that we piss off our international collaborators.
That wasn't just us. That was also Russia.
Yeah, it was also Russia.
Years behind.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it needs to be a commercial endeavor, not a NASA endeavor. And once the commercial sector is ready to go, I'm all for it.
Go for it, Aaron.
Just as Aaron from Slide Astronomy here, I have a few comments on it. I'm against it for the main reason that they are completely decimating the Outer Planets program and the other programs of astronomy at NASA in order to fund this. They're just canceling everything right to the left, including extrasolar planet, the terrestrial planet finders, and all those other missions are getting budgets either slashed to nothing or slashed to postponing level budgets where they have three or four staff members basically just hold on to the papers for a year while they wait till next year. And if you have to make a choice of one or the other, I'm always going to side on the side of science over engineering.
Right.
I certainly agree with the point that there is some side benefits from research. That's definitely true. But if we took that same $20 billion invested in the National Science Foundation, I think we're going to have the same, if not more, you know, side effects to protect society. On a third point, they do say it's going to cost $20 billion. I think it's going to be a lot more than that, but let's say it is $20 billion. You know, imagine with that amount of money, you could probably put a Mi 10-inch telescope in every elementary school in the country. You could probably give an ETX scope to every kid in the country. And can you imagine the amount of outreach that would have, even if they used it for 1 week in a fifth grade class? The rest of their life, they're going to have that in their mind. They're going to be open to science and astronomy. So I just think there's so many better ways to do it. But with that said, there is one way I do have that I think we can go to Mars and make it do it without hurting anything else. And that is, we got to make a reality show around it and make it a one-way trip. So what we do is we go out there and we say, okay, people, the biggest problem with sending humans to Mars is actually getting them back, is launching out of Mars and getting back into space and heading back to Earth. And if you don't have to worry about that, it's actually fairly simple. So let's find some people who are willing to go on a one-way trip, you know, maybe, you know, and I'm sure out of 5.5 billion people, we're going to find three or four people who are willing to do this to go down.
And I'm pretty sure we can all think of three or four people that would like to do it.
That's true. So we send them up there, and then we put cameras all over the ship, everywhere. We make it a 24-hour cable channel, and it's a six-month trip out out there if you do it at the right oppositions and stuff. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have a show for about a year, and it's a 24-hour show, and you use the money that you sell on the ads to fund the trip. They go out there, they walk around the plant, they have a good time for a while, and then they take the little bye-bye capsules.
Oh, my, you killed them at the end.
We can't get them back. I mean, maybe these are people with cancer. You know, maybe these are people who are, for some other reason, they can't live very much.
Well, like you said, these are people who are willing to do it for one reason or the other.
Right.
Accepting that that's going to be the unfortunate, but the outcome that they don't.
And they go down history.
Let's go back real quickly just to talk about, I think it's a point you brought up, Pamela, which is this idea of maybe funding this privately. Is this something that maybe that we should look at? Maybe it shouldn't be NASA's deal. It should be something we can get various companies and various private industry things to do and fund. Is that something that makes anybody have any thoughts on that? Or
getting the private industry involved is absolutely vital. I mean, you know, NASA or the progenitors of NASA aren't involved in cars and getting buildings built and all that stuff. So I mean, the whole point is that NASA's job is to push the envelope and do stuff that industry isn't going to do, but also to do a much better job of bringing industry along for the ride and helping them, you know, take things over. And I think they've forgotten a good part of that, you know, of that being part of their mandate. But, you know, someone explained at one time that, you know, what NASA should be doing is they should be offering people, if people can, they'll pay $100 a pound or $1,000 a pound for, you know, if anyone can launch stuff into orbit. It doesn't matter what it is. It's dirt or water or air. I mean, the point being that private industry will work to make that happen. And so I think of NASA's bureaucracy has in many cases forgotten that objective. So if they can, if there's money to be made out there and NASA can connect it together, then the whole thing would take off on its own.
Gotcha. Anybody else want to chime in?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we're beginning to see a lot of that with some of the millionaires and billionaires. You know, they've made their fortune. Now they're starting to put their money to realize their childhood dreams. So we had the X Prize. I think we'll see more of that. I wonder if, you know, what sort of role the government is going to end up playing in that sort of world where the universe is turning into the playground of the rich.
That's what I was going to say is, if you put it, I think it would work better in private hands, but as soon as you put it into private hands and the government starts losing money, they're going to regulate it and make sure they get every last dime out of every last person. Even if they're not building anything, you know, they'll add on taxes for entering the atmosphere or exiting the atmosphere. And, I mean, they will tax every tiny little thing, because if they lose NASA, they lose a lot of money that, you know, they were paying people. And so now they'll find new ways to get that money.
But isn't part of the beauty of outer space that you can get there from pretty much anywhere in the tropic latitudes? For a while, I think it was Australia was going to build a private launch port. Mm-hmm. And it would be such an easy step for some otherwise poor and impoverished tropical island to become the next best place for launching a spacecraft.
New Guinea's doing that, I think, right? Or...
Yeah, I've lost
Paraguay. Didn't somebody just launch French Guiana. That's it.
I'm sorry. We just said, Derek, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say, didn't somebody just recently launch a satellite from a private airstrip somewhere in the tropics? It might have been what you just said. It might have been French Guiana.
Well, yeah, that's the European Space Agency port, I think. But there's also Sea Launch, which is that private moving oil platform that they launch missiles off of. That's a pretty neat idea. It goes in the port, I think, in Southern California or something, gets loaded up, heads to the tropics, fires away.
Moving on I think it's something that's kind of related here. As Aaron was saying, it's the big difficulty in sending folks out to Mars is, of course, getting them back. And this brings up the topic and the debate or the discussion that exists out there for, should we concentrate now, especially after the recent
Columbia
the disaster? Was it Columbia, right?
It was Columbia.
that says maybe we should start focusing on sending robots into space, robotic spaceflight, and not concentrating on manned spaceflight anymore. How does this change spaceflight? How does this change the whole business? And does anybody have any thoughts on that? Let's start here this time. Aaron, Pamela, anybody?
Well, I have strong feelings, and that is we shouldn't retreat from space, but anything that can be done by a robot should be done by a robot. And right now we do a lot of things by humans that don't have to be done by humans. But there are some things a human has to be involved in. For example, the Hubble repair mission, that's going to have to be done by a human. And if you ever hear any of the astronauts talk about what they do inside that refrigerator-sized room, that they can't, that every single movement is choreographed, I don't think a robot can do that. But definitely, anything that can be done by a robot should be done by a robot, in my opinion.
Well, at the end of the day, space is a place that's not all that kind to human beings, but they're, like you're saying, there's certain things we do better. People in space are construction workers. We are repairmen. And when it comes to doing science, Mars Rover does better than any human being could do in a lot of aspects. You don't have to feed it. It just needs to sit out in the sun. And, the windstorms keep it clean. It doesn't need water to shower in.
Very true.
I have a mixed feeling about that. I know from an economic standpoint and a safety standpoint, sending robots off to do near everything that they can do is great. But for some reason, I think that some of the teeth of the public interest, which also trickles out to funding for science, and especially NASA, gets completely ripped out when it's always a robot. I think some of the interest of NASA was at its height when we would send people to the moon and we did new things like the space shuttle, and people were up there and there was video feeds back, and the human interest story of it really captures the public and people as an entity, their interest, even if they're not interested in necessarily the science of it, the exploration of it. And I think when you don't have that public support, which comes along with the interest of the human element, I think that you lose a lot of public interest, which translates to money at the end of the day. And, it's very sad to bring that down to money, but there are so many people that don't care about the safety aspect. I mean, when you think back to, the days of the Right Stuff, when these guys were trying to break the sound barrier, they didn't care what you put them in. They would go and do it. and everybody loved those guys.
Yeah, I agree with all of what you're saying. And my answer is, let's just go build more stuff. I mean, if you think about the movies out there, was it The Dream is Alive or Solar Max that talked about all of the repair missions out in space, one of the big IMAX films? And then there's the whole Apollo 13 movies. The movies that are getting made are talking about the near disasters averted by people and their clever ability to fix things in space. So let's go build things. Let's go fix things. Let's go be our engineering best. And as much as I'd like to go into space, I'm going to say let's leave the scientists down on the ground.
And there's always monkeys, so we left them out of the whole chain, not just robots, there.
As we learn, and politicians.
And politicians, yes, exactly.
A slightly lower form of life than monkeys. I don't know if we can train them.
They don't throw feces as much, but
actually more.
Well, some do. Anyone else out there? I think we might have lost Mr. Can, I'm noticing there from the screen, but we've got Fraser and Still and Richard and... Anybody else have any thoughts?
It's really kind of difficult that science and exploration are always, having to kind of fight one another for dominance. And I find it kind of it's a kind of an argument that shouldn't be happening, Should I build the terrestrial planet finder or should I send people to the moon? Those are two completely different purposes and completely different missions. And their funding really shouldn't be having to scavenge. So I kind of find that whole process very frustrating. With the recent decision whether or not to repair Hubble, people said, the administrators said that they weren't going to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, and then everyone freaked out, and administrators were changed, and new missions were thought through. And now when the new mission is being... Hubble, it seems more likely that Hubble's going to be repaired again. The next day, you start to hear about the squeeze on the next generation telescopes and the terrestrial planet finder and all those. And it's the same thing with exploration. I really think that it's almost like a conversation that we shouldn't be having, and it's too bad that we do have to have robots and people, all of that.
500 billion to defense, 20 billion to NASA.
Yeah, exactly. Why should we be taking that money out of defense instead? Actually, the Canadian military, we've taken most of that already.
I think it would be different. I think if once the Halliburton purchase of the moon goes through, and if we can get some oil there or on Mars, we'll be in good shape. Anyone else have any thoughts? We've got Mr. Can back. Welcome back, Mr. Can.
Yeah. I figured I got cut off because I was going to disagree with Pamela.
I have the master disconnect switch here. We're going to throw that. No. Go ahead.
This isn't the O'Reilly factor.
I mean, I think robots are good tools, but I think that, the whole reason we're sitting, well, I don't know if everyone is, but I'm sitting in America, is because other people wanted to leave Europe and England, not because they needed to or... I mean, they could have probably sent other people, but everyone came. I mean, that's human nature. I don't think we should replace ourselves with robots. I mean, even if you look at, like, clothing or any manufactured goods, robots can build everything and make everything, but this best stuff still comes from when humans build it and when humans make it. And I guess I'm a... half empty kind of glass. But I think wherever humans can go, they should go. And I don't think we should send robots or monkeys or dogs there to make sure it's safe first.
And the next logical question is, what about robot monkeys? But we'll skip over that for now. We'll skip over that for now. Did you guys have anything else you wanted to add? Pamela, Aaron? Sure. Let's move on, I guess, to, since we are the Council of Doom, another topic. Yeah, we're going to have some frightening music there. My voice will get much lower when we edit this. Gamma ray bursts, asteroids, other astronomical doomsday scenarios. It's all very popular. The public likes it. It's fun to make movies of all that stuff. But is it really science or is it just entertainment at this point? Does anybody want to start discussion on this? Aaron, did you...
I put that in the notes because on AstroPH, which is the preprint server for a lot of the, I'd say probably the majority of the astronomical journal articles get posted, a paper got posted recently talking about, you know, whether GRBs, gamma ray bursts, could have caused some of the extinctions in the past. And most of the time, those get posted quite a bit, and I ignore them. But this time, some of the names on it I recognize. So I forwarded it to a retired astronomer that I know who worked at JPL, and he helped discover the hole in the ozone layer. And he said that he knew one of the people, one of the four, I think, authors on the list, and that he was a straight-up guy, really, really good. So I started paying attention to this, and it made me think, you know, how am I going to know, looking at these articles, which one of these things are real, which one of these aren't? Mm-hmm. I'm lucky that I know some people who can tell me who to listen to and who not to.
Right.
But the media doesn't. For example, when another near-Earth asteroid is discovered that they say is going to hit us in 20 years, I know to ignore it, you know, yeah. Because I know that the margin of error on those things are so large that it's going to be refined, and maybe in 10 years, if it's still going to hit us, then I'll pay attention to it.
Sure.
But the public doesn't know this. So how do we tell the difference between what's really, you know, dangerous and what isn't?
When should we go into the bomb shelter, and when should we just go smile pretty at the heavens?
Well, because it certainly makes good movies, obviously. I mean, you know, the excitement of the asteroid heading toward Earth and all that stuff. But you're right. I think, in general, the average person isn't going to know necessarily what to make of it, and gamma ray bursts to the guy who doesn't know what they are. I mean, that sounds spooky. I'd be frightened of the gamma ray bursts. You know, that turns people into superheroes and stuff, so it does have some cool elements to it, but nevertheless, a little spooky. Anybody, let's turn it over to the panel now. Does anybody have any thoughts on this?
Well, anything they want to say? On asteroids, you know, potential asteroids and how they're going to strike the Earth, and that gamma ray burst story as well. And I think it's just a matter of the media getting a little more savvy about these stories that they, I always write mine with a certain amount of skepticism and try and coach the how insignificant the chances are that everyone's going to die. At the same time, you know, scientifically, it is an interesting find. There is a rock. It has a trajectory. It has, you know, right now some probability chances. And then you can explain give people the context. And I think that, you know, the media has kind of embarrassed itself a couple of times about those kinds of stories in the past. I almost worry what happens if, you know, it's almost like a case of the crying wolf, where the media just gives up on reporting these stories, or the public gets bored when something of significant interest actually starts to come together. But other than that, I don't think, I think that the media will learn over time, you know, the more mainstream media will learn over time how to report these stories more accurately. And a specialist media like myself, we've already learned.
Frazier, in your experience, how well do those articles do versus the others on your site in terms of popularity? Are they more popular among your readers, less popular, the same?
Crazy popular.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all sort of the Google zeitgeist, right? So if you happen to be a popular link in Google for a certain kind of, asteroid 2004 MN4 or whatever it is, then if people are searching that in when they hear it on CNN that a spacewalk is coming our way, then yeah, I get a lot of traffic in a day around this kind of event. So, the kind of evil part of me says, hype it up, but the more real who wants to maintain a long-term audience and educate.
So to use Phil Plait's term, you're the asteroid whore trying to use asteroids.
I'm actually more of the lunar eclipse whore.
So there's still the asteroid whore title for everyone who's listening is still available. If anyone's interested in that, just wanted to throw that out there.
So are lunar eclipses the most popular on your site?
Yeah. When a lunar eclipse is happening, the traffic gets pretty high.
Very good. Anyone else? Any thoughts they want to share?
Yes, I wanted to add that I don't think just the mainstream media is kind of having this problem. I notice on space.com a lot, they almost seem like a tabloid to me. They recently, it's not just with the doomsday stuff, though. For them, it happens to be every time someone suggests that there might be life on Mars or some other apparent discovery. And they call it, in their image, they say a space.com exclusive, someone verifies life on Mars or something like that. And while I think, astrobiology is fascinating, I wonder about all this tabloid-esque sort of attention to either doomsday scenarios or the discovery of life.
Right.
And they're not checking, to make absolutely certain that it's a real story. In fact, the more recent one from Space, NASA sent out a press release to say, no, we are not making this claim.
It's kind of frustrating because one of the problems the cold fusion guys have is there's some folks out there who may actually be doing cold fusion, although they're not getting more energy out than they're putting in. But they can't get anyone to listen to what they're doing because so many people have done cold fusion badly in the media that no legitimate source is going to touch it with a 2,000 kiloparsec long pole.
For suicide.
And so is there any concern that if we keep...
That's a good point. Does anybody else have anything they wanted to share?
I think the nail was hit on the head when it was said that it generates hits to your website or it generates interest in the story. I think mainstream news, no matter how much you educate them, I don't think that it matters. I think they're just, a lot of these news sources are just running to whatever sells magazines, whatever gets hits on the website, mm-hmm. whatever gets ratings.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. I mean, if Space.com, when they did that story, within 12 hours, references to that story showed up in, all the usual places.
All right.
Dodd, FARC, and all those guys. So, you know that within that one day, Space.com, being the people who announced definitive life on Mars,
mm-hmm.
raked in the bucks.
Yeah.
And knowing that they put in however much, $80 million in investment into that company and they're trying to figure out a way to get back, you can see the publisher leaning on the reporters to get those spikes in traffic. So, and I think all of, and the other mainstream media as well, if you can say that space rock is going to kill us all, you'll be able to get people to buy your newspaper.
If it bleeds, it leads. And if the blood happens to be green and from Mars, it's better. And if the blood happens to come from every single human being, that's even better still.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the point. It's what will end up happening is they know they can print a retraction or the full story the next day and just say, well, we didn't have all the facts. And then they have more people that are interested in going to their website and, you know, or watching their news show. And it's just quick turnaround advertising.
So in politics, if anyone in the media like came out and suddenly said, Governor so-and-so from Bible Belt State in the middle of the country is having an affair, and then it turned out that, yeah, it was just him and his niece going for a walk through the park, and they retracted the story the next day, whoever wrote the story would lose their job, and they would potentially lose their career. Why is it that the bar is so different when applied to science?
I think I may be able to answer that. I think because they expect that the readership will see it as science fiction from the beginning, that they'll be skeptical anyway. So if they have to retract it, no harm done. It kind of in our time, I think it's interesting that there are so many things that are occurring that used to be just science fiction, but it makes it really hard to view these news stories and read these news stories when you don't know if someone's hyping something or if it really did occur. And like Carl Sagan has suggested in some of his books, you have to have both that awe for what's happening, but a healthy skepticism. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that everyone has both.
So how do we teach the media that there's so much cool shit actually going on in science that they should just report on the truth and leave the science fiction for the science fiction section at Barnes & Noble?
That was going to be my next question, nicely done, Pamela.
Sorry.
No, I know what I'm saying. That was good. The answer is I don't know.
So do any of you all know?
I don't think you can. The media will always sensationalize. People will always buy rolls of duct tape and plastic. And you can get hit by a bus tomorrow, so I don't think the media is going to change. I don't think politics are going to change, and I don't think stupid people are going to change.
A science watchdog group may be able to do something. You know, if there's a web page and a group of people who subscribe to it via email, and they got, you know, 10,000 subscribers or something, people pay attention to that. You know, and if they illustrated, you know, what basically the ombudsman's role, you know, that they do, like at the Post or something like that, and they kept watch on this kind of stuff and reported it when it went wrong, mm-hmm. You know, space.com would be a lot more careful because they will,
if they knew someone was out there,
lose readers. They'll get that one day hit, but they'll get a long trend, you know, going down. Investors are a lot more concerned about that.
Definitely what we're talking about here is that other trend of the media having to, it's the blurring of the lines between news and traditional media and entertainment, and that the news stations these days, be it a 24-hour cable station or your local news or whatever, is essentially competing with all the entertainment programming. So, and that's not something that's going to go away anytime soon. So that, and that's part of what we've been talking about, is that, you know, they have to get the ratings. They've got to go for what's going to keep them on the air, what's going to get them the money, what's going to get them the advertisers. So I think there are so many, you know, there are so many symptoms to the problem that I don't think there's one good way we can even keep, you know, we certainly can't solve the problem, but there's so many different aspects of it that I think it's tough to target any one thing and have the media change. That certainly probably won't. So,
well, maybe us podcasters can do it.
There you go. Anyone else have any thoughts on that?
Illusions of grandeur.
Well, quite
possible.
Well, I think that just comes
up. Something you can do overnight. I mean, you're talking about so many levels. You want people to have an understanding and appreciation for science, technology, and ability to see pseudoscience and stuff with a certain amount of skepticism and all that. And I don't think that there's any kind of quick fix. It's more of a symptom of sort of the society at large at this point, which is kind of ironic because it's so dependent on that science and technology. But, you know, I think that it's the kind of the grassroots stuff, sidewalk astronomy, you know, going down to your local schools and talking to people about science. You got to create a new generation of people who are have a much better appreciation of it. So I think that, you know, if you talk to most regular people, you know, my neighbor doesn't think that that we've ever been into space. And I'm like, well, I'm like, you've just got a satellite television. I said, look, where do you think that dish is pointing? Okay, so maybe those have gone up into space. So the point is that, you know, people don't really care. They just use the output of it. And I think that, you know, you can have people be more interested in the wonder and amazement of it and at the same time be skeptical and so on, then I think. But it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up a good point there on the somebody doesn't think we've ever been into space before. Too bad I don't have the name and the story in front of me so I can get the facts right. But there was actually a member of parliament in England who got applause when he mentioned that or insinuated that we never actually had been to the moon as the United States.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it happened. And what was it, about a month ago? I think so. And I mean, he didn't get it.
Recently.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's because of the anti-American sentiment that's been going on, and, you know, he got some applause for it. And it was insinuated in a long string of complaints that he had, you know, about how we like to bluster and bolster, and, you know, if we couldn't find WMDs and we lied about that, you know, think about all the other things we could have potentially lied about, and he went on and on and on about it. So it's amazing how even that sort of talk, like you said, your neighbor could even start to believe that. And I think just a general disillusionment with government sometimes brings with it a disillusionment with science in general, because most of our science programs have been perpetuated by government funding. So they associate with the government.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
And say, if you look, I'm down here in Kansas, and they're having an argument right now of whether or not they should teach evolution. And, I mean, if you think back to the Scopes monkey trial, you think that that settled the case. Well, I mean, here we are, what is it, 50 years later or more, and here in the middle of Kansas, they're fighting over whether or not it's a scientific theory or not. I mean, that's one of the big arguments here, is whether or not evolution even can be defined as a scientific theory. And then on the same side, if you look in Kansas, we have the Cosmosphere, which is the largest collection in the world of space artifacts. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, if anyone goes down there, I was there recently, they have one of the only V2s. They have a ton of Russian space stuff that they got after the collapse of communism.
I think they were actually talking too. I read that article that they wanted to make some group wanted to make a creationist museum.
Oh, yeah. So
I'm not exactly sure what. Oh, it does exist.
Yeah.
Not sure what would be in that exactly. It'd be interesting.
I am.
But again,
maybe the recipe needed to create the art.
Yes, perhaps. In a big, like, you know, pot with a wooden spoon in it. Mix it up.
I am 10 minutes from Cobb County, Georgia. So. Yeah, being 10 minutes from Cobb County, Georgia, you just like in Kansas, I get to hear this stuff all the time.
Yeah. Well, the audio from the Kansas trials is actually available free from audible.com, so we can all go listen in and laugh at Kansas together.
Right. Sorry, Mr. Pitt, I'm sorry.
Hey, I got a
and again, it's see, evolution, it all comes back to monkeys in space, is what I've been trying to point out. Let's, as we head toward wrapping up the Council of Doom, let's move to a slightly more lighthearted topic, I guess. I'm going to ask each one of you now, maybe you need a little, you know, a couple 30 seconds to think about this. What would be the best, in your mind, the best, we're talking about hard science here, science fiction movie? So think about it in terms of it's good hard science. It's on the ball in terms of science stuff goes. Science fiction movie. Derek, I'm starting with you because you're on top and you're the top.
Can I pick a TV show?
Sure.
Okay.
Let me consult the rule book. Yes, you can. It's all good.
It must be fiction.
Yes. Must be fiction.
From a hard science standpoint, because of the groundbreaking efforts that they did in a lot of different ways, not necessarily the story, although I kind of enjoyed it myself, but it was a bit dry. Babylon 5.
Yeah.
It was an awesome story.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I mean, I'm not speaking to it from a critical standpoint of the story. I'm talking about it from a hard science standpoint.
Yeah.
And, I might have some, you know, some love there because I did do some work on some of the 3D stuff that was in that movie. But to me, that was a great first. It was the first time I think that a mainstream media outlet like a TV show really kind of showed how space really is. The whole it's always quiet. There was no up, no down. They even built the ships like, you know, that organic flavor that they would really be in, and you know they always were catawampus to each other, and it was very cool. And I think later on in the series when they got to the second spinoff series or that first spinoff series, they actually worked with some folks from NASA Jet Propulsion Labs to get the physics right too on the propulsion systems.
Frazier, what about you?
I'm going to go with it. Well, I guess if my neighbor's right and we haven't been to space, then I'm going to go for Apollo 13 as the science fiction. But I'm going to go with the TV show, which is Stargate, which is, I think, my...
Oh.
I'm going to enjoy Stargate.
No. I enjoy the Daniel Jackson.
I mean, not with the... you know, the wormhole and parasite monsters and so on, and floating pyramids. But a lot of the, you know, the science solutions that they have to deal with and a lot of the problems they have to deal with, a lot of the solutions they come up with kind of ring true to me as, you know, someone who's an enthusiast for science. You know, there's one whole episode where they were dealing with a black hole that was going to suck the wormhole in.
And that was a good one.
It was pretty, you know, well handled. Sort of discussing all of the things that you might see if you were nearby a black hole. So I think, I'm going to go with Stargate.
Very good. Richard, your thoughts?
Well, in movies and televisions to date, I don't think there's really been anything that is really hard science fiction to me. There's a lot I would like to see done. Like, for example, I'd love to see a movie about the technological singularity, Werner Vinge's ideas, and maybe some sort of dramatization of that. If I had to pick a movie that I enjoyed that had some interesting science in it, I might get laughed at, but the movie AI, the first third of the movie, though, the rest of the movie was horrible, but the very first the first third of the movie had me captivated. It was kind of showing people and how they might deal with you know, androids and human-looking robots. I definitely want to see more of that in fiction. I don't know if we're going to get that, though.
Very good. Mr. Can, your selection.
My selection... The 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah. That was mine too.
It's a long movie. The first words aren't spoken until 45 minutes into the movie. But I think that opening, or not the opening scene, but one of the early scenes where he's flying into the space station and it's spinning, and you see the ship, his space shuttle spinning, or whatever. I guess he's on like a taxi, basically. I mean, as quiet as that movie is, and I think that's my favorite. It's tough to sit through, but it's worth sitting through.
Pamela, did you have one? Please, Aaron.
You know, I have to admit, I got cable to watch Babylon 5 when it moved to TNT, and I kept cable to watch Stargate when it moved to the Sci-Fi Channel. So my two have already been taken. There's something about shows. The thing with Stargate, two of the leading characters have PhDs, and the fact that they show that these people can think outside of their fields and that it's all about problem solving. I love that. They stress problem solving over and over and over again. And with Babylon 5, the fact that they actually wore space suits while flying around in their little one-person rocket ships, I can't think of any other show prior to that that did that. I have great hopes for Battlestar Galactica, but I'm just not sure they're going to get things right.
That's right. I forgot about that. Babylon 5 was probably, I'd probably have to go with that.
Yeah.
As well. So that was kind of anticlimactic. I was trying to think something else. But great. I think we're gonna. Are we Planet of the Apes?
Planet of the Apes?
No.
No. Okay.
Oh, especially the new one. That was great.
Yes. See, and monkeys again, getting into trouble yet saving the day.
Exactly. Futurama. That's
a great. Anything else as we wrap up the
any
very first Council of Doom?
Words.
Any last words here on the Council of Doom?
Why don't we do the worst hard science movie?
Okay, let's do that. What, did you have
Core?
That was mine.
Yeah.
He stole mine, the Core.
Well, that was based on a true story, wasn't it, guys?
Oh, or the day after tomorrow.
No, that was actually based on two journal articles in Nature. It took things to extremes, but it was based on two journal articles in Nature.
Okay. It was also based on a book written by Art Bell.
Yes. It was actually. What was that? The quickening?
Yeah, I don't know. I saw that on an airplane flying to the Philippines once, and it was an excruciating experience. I turned off the I took off the earphones for the last half of the movie, and I enjoyed it a lot more.
Wait, why can't I think of which movie? The Day After Tomorrow was.
That's the one where they the whole ocean freezes basically.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, everything drops to absolute zero.
Okay,
the whole absolute zero thing was wrong, but.
The entire movie.
Why can't I think of what was the one with the Bruce Willis and
Armageddon.
Armageddon.
Thank you. That was a fun.
That was pretty.
That
great.
Was just mind click.
What did they do? They did a 40,000 G slingshot around the sun or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and then there's Deep Impact where they calculated an orbit from one image.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably going to do some slingshot loops around the sun this weekend. It's a long weekend. You know, so if anybody wants to join me, let me know.
The beer's cold.
And what a more perfect way to end this first inaugural edition of the Council of Doom. I want to thank you guys so much for being part of the show, Derek and Fraser and Richard. Mr. Kent, thank you so much for contributing, and thank you, Derek, also for hosting the technological side of this thing and your computer. We appreciate that.
Oh, no problem.
And
also, we hope we'll see how we all feel after this, but hope that this can be a recurring thing between
absolutely.
Us, between the
yes.
different podcasts.
That'd be nice.
And I'd also like to mention to the audience that all of us have the rights to record and use as much as little of this show as possible. So tune in to everybody's individual podcast and listen and see how they decide to, you know, display it. Everyone's going to have different interpretations of this.
And for you guys, I don't know if you're recording any of it or not, but if you need the audio from us, we can send you. I can send you what I have here. So,
okay.
We're all one big happy sharing unit.
I recorded. I recorded the whole thing as well, so I have another version of it. I'll put it out there and send a link to everybody.
That's great.
Sounds
great.
Good.
Thank you.
Well,
can I have a new name for you? Monkeys in space.
Monkeys in
there
space.
I like it.
Sensationalized monkeys in space.
Sensationalized monkeys from space of doom.
Of doom.
Okay,
and
you know,
on that note,
part 9.
So we have to have catastrophe. Fraser taught us that. You
right.
People that listen, we need some catastrophe.
Ironically, on the news segment that happens at the beginning of our podcast every week, we always have one monkey story.
Staying perfect.
Then we're going to be your story next week, right?
And
it might be.
We should
actually.
All be using apes for Windows. So, on that note, clear skies and clear bandwidth. This has been an initiated effort of Slacker Astronomy, a podcast for fun, for you, for the voices in our heads.
A list of links to the podcasts participating in the Astronomical Council of Doom can be found on the Radio Frontier Channel website at radio.frontierchannel.tv. look for the link to the Episode 8 show notes. Please call the Radio Frontier Channel hotline at 206-202-3311 or email frontierchannel@frontierchannel.tv with your comments. Thank you for listening, and please join me next time for more news and commentary from the frontiers of science and technology.